Hi, I'm Wendy Shillam and welcome to this podcast. I'm sharing with you a talk I gave last week at EcoBuild 2012, asking the question, what will really save us from climate change? I've broken down your and my carbon footprint under four main headings. These headings, by the way, are the ones that the World Wildlife Fund chooses to use. Everyone's carbon footprint is different, but for most of us in the Western world, our footprint can roughly be divided equally between these four: travel, home, food, and stuff. Now, stuff is where many of our eco-towns lose out. It's consumption that is tending to raise all our carbon emissions. The importation of goods, their manufacture, their packaging, their sales and distribution, not to mention that little three-pin electrical plug that comes attached to many of them. Ironically, the easiest and cheapest thing we could all do is to stop shopping. The most expensive thing we can do is to change the way we live. Retrofitting our homes or buying new ones are both expensive options. So you may ask, why does government spend so much time trying to get us to live in eco-housing when there would be so many cheaper ways of limiting our carbon footprint? Take a look at these figures. Again, they're broad trends, not detailed stats. If you consider the cost to governments of reducing carbon footprint, you will see that for them, changing the way we live is the cheapest option. We pay for our housing in rent, in utility bills, and in mortgages. The government has no fiscal input. In fact, when we move, we tend to trigger a mini boom by spending more on curtains, carpets, furniture, DIY, and getting a man in. Stimulating the building industry is one of the easiest ways to get people back into work. All this consumerism is grist to the Chancellor's mill. I want to tell you how I think we as urban designers can design new cities to reduce all four lines of the chart without ruining the economy. Here's the familiar hierarchy of travel options that give greener outcomes. But of course, some are cheaper than others to provide. By designing a city so that walking and cycling are easier, we not only reduce the need for more expensive public transport infrastructure, we also focus on the most sustainable travel options. I suppose the best option is not to travel at all, which is why living and working in the same building, reducing your carbon footprint by up to 20% at a stroke. Cycling works in big cities as well as small ones. Here is one of the McDonald's-funded cycling centres right in the heart of Chicago. You can hire a bike, get a map, get your bike repaired, safely park your bike, or even take cycling proficiency classes. I never thought I'd have the bravery to cycle right in the middle of a US city. But I can report that the experience in Chicago was really enjoyable. It provides a network of well-organised cycle routes, many of them are off-road, and some follow beautiful lakeside parks. Because of this, cycling commuting is increasing all over the city. Chicago is now recognized as the best big city for cycling in North America. By 2015, they plan that 5% of local trips will be made on a bike. Nothing like what we have in Europe, especially the Low Countries, but it's a pretty good go. What we eat and where it comes from plays a vital role in our carbon footprint. Governments have been loath to get involved with this quite sensitive issue. It's not just about buying local, though that can help. It's about reducing your consumption of meat. It's about changing where and what we purchase. Even better if we grow our own. This is the rooftop of Budgeon in Crouch End in London, where a Grow Your Own cooperative has linked up with the supermarket to provide shoppers with fantastic fruit and veg all year round. This wartime dig for victory leaflet suggests that you need 90 foot by 30 foot, that's a whopping 270 square metres, to feed a family of four. Now here is the modern way of providing a similar supply, by using more intensive farming methods, by intercropping, by succession cropping, and by using cut and come again varieties. Modern horticulturalists suggest that you can feed a family of four from just 17 square metres. That changes the scale of the gardens we need and changes their value. So how do we deal with this pesky virus, the shopping bug? The problem is that shopping is so inextricably linked to our economy, to our well-being. How can we enjoy a better lifestyle and stimulate the economy in different ways? Here are a few ideas. Sports and cultural activities are much lower in carbon footprint and probably better for us. And in terms of intellectual property, there's real economies to be made. There's real money to be made. Economics does not have to be about making things. But we don't hold the monopoly on intellectual property. This is a picture of the workers at Ghost, an internet security company who now work out of Gaza. No products can be exported from there, so this enterprising multi-ethnic group are exporting their knowledge via the internet. The company has become internationally successful. I'm trying to bring each of these ideas back to some sort of image of urban design. What does an intellectually rich urban landscape look like? This is a plan of the area around the Bodleian Library in Oxford. Pevsner described this as one of the most successful pieces of townscape ever. You will see that it possesses a number of elements we've spoken about before. Small roads which do not link through, direct routes for cycle and walking, a higher percentage of green space. Of course, they don't grow veg in these groves of academe, but they do grow ideas, and ideas are certainly one of the lifelines of a modern economy. I've left house building to the last because it's the trickiest one to get right. And today at the EcoBuild show, surrounded by a myriad of eco ideas, it's very easy to see how we could throw money and technology at the problem and still come out carbon heavy. My first suggestion is improvement by increment. This slide shows the growth pattern of Washington and Baltimore over 200 years, between 1792 and 1992. All too often people say it must all come up front, that infrastructure like this cannot be afforded. What we need to do is plan for incremental growth. A village of 100 houses needs far less infrastructure than a development of 500 or 10,000 homes. But any new town starts with those first 100 homes. So it starts life as a village, not as a fully formed city. Starting small is a good idea, carbon footprint wise. This is Abundance, Iowa, an eco-village designed for just 70 souls. It's off-grid. They grow their own food, use wind and solar power to generate electricity, and waste is disposed of in reed beds at the bottom of the development. It's low density, but it's within walking distance of downtown Fairfield, and it's light, very light, on infrastructure. The green line here indicates what our average levels of energy consumption were back in the 60s. If we could go back to those times and those lifestyles, we'd achieve our carbon emission reductions at a stroke. Remember the day when the 60-watt lamp in the centre of the room was considered adequate lighting? But this image from the Festival of Britain is a reminder that times were not so bad then. The best way to save energy is never to use it in the first place. Perhaps we should all take a leaf out of Detective Sarah Lund's book. Perhaps today we should turn down the heating and just wear an extra jumper. That would be the cool way to keep warm. That would be the cool way to save the planet. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave a message for me, Wendy Shillam, at www.coffeeinthesquare.com. And thanks for listening.